Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm delighted to be joined today by Seb Stafford-Bloor. Hi, Seb.
Hello, Joe Devine.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, very keen there. Very keen hello. Before I've even finished...
I've got energy. I'm cutting off all the time. Yeah. It's the thing I most enjoy.
JJ Bull the Bullet.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Yes.
Delightful. Okay. And also, we're very pleased to be joined today by Chris Kamrani, all the way from the United States of America and the Athletic's soccer vertical. Hi, Chris. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
How are you doing today? Did you enjoy that game?
Yeah, like I said earlier, I think I have more questions for you than you might have for me, but we can get into that soon enough.
Good. Well, hopefully I don't have to answer them because I know nothing. But listen, we'll be talking about so much today, including, of course, the England-USA game. We're going to talk about probably what was maybe the most fun game of the day, the early game, Wales and Iran. Bid on Netherlands and Ecuador. Qatar, of course, out of the tournament already. Senegal getting a nice win there. And some first round takeaways from JJ, who wasn't here yesterday when the first round of games ended. So we'll be doing that a little bit later. Delighted to see that he looks surprised to hear me.
No, I've written it down.
You've written it down.
Yeah.
That's good news. Well, if you like stuff written down, then you'll love The Athletic. Visit theathletic.com/TIFO. Theathletic.com/TIFO, where you can avail yourselves of a lovely deal at the moment, can't you, Seb?
You really can. It's a special Black Friday deal.
Yeah.
And I think it's £1 a month for 6 months or for a year. It's one of the two. We should have learned before we came on the podcast.
I think it's 6 months. But anyway, either way.
Either is a great
it's
deal.
It's very good. Do you know what? Really it's always when it's Black Friday. It's always around Thanksgiving, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Happy Thanksgiving, America.
Happy Thanksgiving, Chris. Did you enjoy yourself, Chris?
Yeah, I'm still having a bit of a tryptophan hangover from all of the turkey I digested yesterday. Luckily enough, this match was at noon my time as opposed to the early match, which was 3 a.m. my time.
And of course, also, there wasn't lots of adrenaline in this game, so you didn't have to worry about all that food sitting heavy on your stomach because there was really nothing to be excited about, was there? But of course, we'll come to discuss that more. Fine. In which case, I will leave you then in the warm hands and the cool embrace of Chris Kamrani. Yes, lovely. Okay, let's begin, of course, where else? With England, nil USA. Chris, let me come to you first. We thought the USA played very well in this game, and their performance was probably a bit more evenly spaced throughout the game as opposed to against Wales, where they played very well in the first half, less well in the second. What do you think they did well in this game?
I think Greg Berhalter won the tactical battle against Gareth Southgate. I don't think England was able to adjust to the flat 4-4-2 that the U.S. came out and played. And they played extremely direct, kind of the way Wales did against the U.S. in that second half of the opener. And it just seemed like the U.S. had more in the tank than the English players did, especially in the second half. I think England had the better of the play the first 20, 25 minutes. But after that, the U.S. midfield, I thought, was very, very impressive. Playing Weston McKennie, who is predominantly a central holding midfielder at times, playing him basically as a right winger to combine with players like Serginho Dest and Tim Weah, I thought was a stroke of genius. And I think England had a very difficult time adjusting to that. And oddly enough, as you guys know, the England midfield in that opener against Iran was so dominant with Declan Rice and Jude Bellingham, but they were completely non-existent because of the way the U.S. were able to set themselves up and basically win so many 50-50 balls. And I think American fans can be proud of the performance, but I think you have to look back on this match the same way you'll look back on that Wales match and think there were 3 points there to be had, believe it or not.
Yeah. JJ, you mentioned during the game that Weston McKennie was sort of standout for you. What was it that he did so well?
He did all the things you need him to do as a midfielder. Like we're just saying there, he was joining up on the right wing an awful lot. So like USA's out of possession shape was a 4-4-2, but it's actually a full sort of 4-3-3 because Pulisic was pushing up to join in. And then they were attacking with Wright and Weah through the middle, and McKennie would help out on the right wing as well. And sometimes the fullback would overlap or underlap. McKennie was just good at giving a bit of bite and drive to that team. I think as much as USA had control of that game and the players like McKennie looked really good, I think England basically were set up to just see that out as a draw. I don't think they tried. Mm. They played tournament football and didn't expend any energy, so they'll have loads left for the next game. They're already through now,
yeah,
basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chris, can I ask you a question about the sort of perception of soccer within the States, particularly in a big game like this? Obviously, it's a World Cup. You're against England. I heard a colleague of yours, Sam, on the Athletic Football Podcast this morning describing the USA soccer team, the men's team, as wanting to maybe beat England more than any other team to earn their respect. Do you think that's true?
I think so, just because the fact that this roster has so many players that have either played in the EPL or are currently playing there, these players know each other. And you just start at the top. Christian Pulisic is teammates with guys like Connor Gallagher and Mason Mount. These are guys that he's known for a very long time. So the familiarity between these two sides runs pretty deep compared to, let's say, when the U.S. plays Iran on Tuesday. There is going to be basically zero familiarity. But I think it's an easy rivalry to tap into. I don't want to, you know, fall back into all of the very tired cliche historical barbs that Americans tend to throw out when we, you know, play England in a match. But I mean, the 2010 match, as you remember, was also a big deal. Mm-hmm. Also, oddly, a very I don't know. I think it was a stinker. I remember, yeah, you know,
it was boring,
poor Rob Green had that shocker, and then. Other than that, it wasn't that intriguing of a match. So I don't know if going forward we can find a way for FIFA to not allow the U.S. and England to play in group stage. Now, if we're talking about knockout stages, I think that would be way, way more interesting. Hmm. But I agree with, you know, what you guys have been saying. I think England didn't want to expend that much energy necessarily. And you could tell as the U.S. got on the front foot, really charged for that goal. England was very much content to see the game out, make sure to protect Harry Kane's ankle at all costs, obviously, and you know, not totally drain the gas tank ahead of what, well, I assume will be a pretty emotional rivalry match for themselves against Wales coming up on Tuesday as well.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, you know, draw for England kind of suits, I suppose. I think they have to suffer fairly heavy defeat to Wales in order to not qualify now. The USA, 2 points after two games, going into the final game against Iran, needing a win. You mentioned earlier that it was the early game today was at 3 a.m. your time, so I don't know if you caught the Wales-Iran game, but Iran looked very strong today. How do you feel about the USA's chances going into that game?
Yeah, ironically enough, I'm actually of Persian descent. My dad's from Iran, so I actually woke up to change my son's diaper at the 70th minute. It was about 4:30 a.m., and I sat in bed and watched the finish. Obviously, a fantastic result for that team. Pertaining to the U.S.-Iran showdown, I think the U.S. have their work cut out for them. I think Iran showed who they were today, albeit against a lesser side in Wales, and they got their stuff handed to them by England in the first match. But Iran will be a very difficult team for the U.S. to break down. They'll be similar to Wales. Iran is going to defend deep, and they have quality players. I mean, I think you can argue that Iran has, after England, Iran has the highest quality attacking players that have scored and performed at the club level. And I say that with guys like Mehdi Taremi, who has been Porto's superstar in Champions League for the last couple of years. This is not going to be an easy match for the U.S. And it's, you know, now both teams have everything to play for. Iran is also, I guess we could argue, is in the driver's seat as well in terms of, you know, being able to see out results the way they want to. And it's going to be a fascinating game of cat and mouse between Greg Berhalter and Carlos Queiroz, because Iran, with those three massive points, are going to be able to set themselves up a little differently as opposed to having to maybe chase a win. I think Iran is going to muck it up as much as they possibly can. And this U.S. team, while they're tremendously talented and young, they've historically had a hard time breaking down teams that dare them to break them down with very long, intricate spells of possession, even as we saw today against England.
Yeah. Well, Seb, you know, I often think this is like one of the most exciting times in the World Cup when the second games of the group stages start and are finished, and you get an idea of the landscape, you know what teams need going into the final game. USA-Iran is just one of a few already big games that we're excited for next week. Well, I mean, you've watched both of those teams fairly closely and you're impressed with the US today,
yeah,
but you were also impressed with Iran. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I was very impressed with Iran's resilience because I think this side that, well, the performance they gave against England was clearly deeply affected by context. I think JJ said that at the time. I think we were kind of unimpressed by Iran, but actually they came back and they were absolutely excellent. So that's in their favour. But I think it'd be a mistake to present them just as a kind of a tough nut to crack. The football they played, particularly the kind of the way they built attacking phases and the way that they kind of exploited the Welsh weaknesses was absolutely superb. The goalkeeper had a great game. Remember, also, the goalkeeper had a great game having seen, well, the player who's ahead of him in the pecking order suffer a really nasty injury in the first game. He only has 7 caps, I think, Hosseini. He was excellent. So I couldn't be more impressed. And I think it's funny, like whenever you see something like what's happened to Iran take place during a World Cup, I always feel like you never want to have to get something off that team. They're riding some sort of emotional current, I guess. But yeah, I think what was interesting today is that the USA we saw in the first game was, I'm not sure which one we expected to show up, whether it was the kind of the first half against Wales or the second. This was very much the first half side, but this was a kind of 70-80 minute performance. And I kind of disagree with JJ a little bit because I think England were a little bit reserved and they were quite conservative, but I also think there were some big failings and the Americans exploited them really, really well. I thought they were superior. And particularly midfield, I was really, really impressed by the kind of connectivity between those three players, Adams, McKennie and Musa. I thought that was excellent, far better than the English trio. So I wouldn't like to call a winner. I think what's important, given some of the conversations about like Champions League dead rubbers and non-event games in sort of domestic leagues, it's really good to go into a third round of group games thinking, I want to watch that game. Mm-hmm. In the same way, for instance, that I'm really looking forward to seeing Ecuador against Senegal in the other group that played today. These are great games with loads of things at stake, and they're also occasions. Iran-USA is a massive game in all sorts of different ways, and that's having an awful lot of sporting jeopardy at stake is clearly to its benefit. So sure. Yeah, I wouldn't like to call a winner though, Joe.
No, it's a tough one.
Yeah.
Chris, in terms of your expectations of how England would play today, even just in terms of performance level and how they did play, what did you think? And I mean, were you surprised by how poor they were?
I was surprised that players like Raheem Sterling, players like Harry Kane, Saka, they just were not that much of a factor going forward. And I have to not fall victim to the moment of how tantalizing they were in that opener against Iran, because I mean, they had their way with Iran, which is to be polite. to me, I was surprised that a player that I think is one of the best players in the world, regardless of age, Phil Foden, couldn't find his way into this match, who I think has the caliber of skill to single-handedly, you know, win himself a game or win his country a game. The fact that a player like Phil Foden is on the bench when England so desperately needed a spark, I found really interesting. And both of the manager's substitution patterns were interesting as well. I mean, bringing on Marcus Rashford with about 8 or 9 minutes left, I thought Rashford could have played a huge role, either playing him centrally if you wanted to go to a formation where you play him alongside Kane or play him out wide. It just seemed like players that have a tremendous combination of skill and pace and technical ability, the players that we saw on full display against Iran, just seemed off today. So it was a disappointing performance for me. Ironically enough, I was texting with, you know, one of my closest friends who is a diehard England fan. He grew up on an Air Force base in England. So even though he's American, you know, diehard Three Lions fan, Harry Maguire, I thought, was the man of the match for England. Yeah. I mean, especially in that second half when the U.S. were pumping crosses and corners into the box, it seemed like Harry Maguire got to every one, and they were all dangerous balls delivered in from Christian Pulisic. So I guess Harry Maguire gets to survive for another day, and maybe we'll be let off the hook a little bit by the English press going into this finale against Wales.
Don't bet on it, Chris.
Phil Foden, though, it's a good point raised by Chris. Phil Foden, JJ, we had the same conversation when we were watching it. We debated whether or not he did come on in the first game. We think he did towards the end.
He did, definitely did.
Yeah. He didn't come on in this game. Why do you think that is? You've got some ideas, don't you?
Well, I think it's because he might give the ball away by trying things that will open up the opposition. Because what you can, so Grealish gets the ball, you put him on the wing, he dribbles a bit, he draws fouls, he gets you move the pitch slowly like rugby.
Yeah.
That's what he does. Sterling can get in behind, you trust him because he's a leader, captain, legend.
Yeah.
And he's just, he's fast, he gets in behind basically is what he does.
And he's got a goal scoring record in big tournaments.
Yeah, I think it's more for his, I guess so, yeah. Saka is good defensively and will do whatever the manager tells him and is also good at driving with the ball. Doesn't try things. He tends to make things happen when he knows they definitely will come off.
It sounds like you're saying Phil Foden doesn't get on the pitch because he might do something.
Yeah, I know it sounds stupid.
Which is the same reason maybe you would want him on the pitch.
Yes, but the whole point is to not make mistakes. So like, I love Phil Foden as well. Yeah. I love watching him play. And he would get in the Spain team and would be one of their best players right now in the way they play. Perfect. Southgate doesn't play like that. He plays to minimize mistakes and keep it really nice and tight and control it. And try and conserve your energy against the USA, really slow tempo. Like, USA could easily have won that game, easily with some of the breaks they had on. Equally, I mean, that the free kick at the end almost went in with, was it Kane that headed it wide?
Yeah.
And that's what Southgate's playing for, that one.
It was the 93rd minute. I mean, I think it was an uncontested header. I think it was just a bit of an awkward angle.
He kind of shanked it wide with his head, didn't he? But, like, you can, I mean, I think you could have changed things really early on because they were playing this, it was the 4-3-3, but slightly. What's the word? Not lopsided. What's the word?
Asymmetrical.
Yeah. Because Mount effectively goes near like Sterling and Kane and Saka in a line. Can I draw a line? I've got a board up for you if you're listening to this on the podcast.
Incidentally, this is a good moment for me to mention for people listening to the podcast. You can watch us live on YouTube immediately after the final game of any game day. You can see what JJ is doing on the board, although he'll try to do a good job of narrating it for the listeners.
I'm going
to
try really hard, yes. Because what USA were doing, they had Weah and Wright were the two forwards. So the block would start with these two. And then you have Rice, it plays between the triangle of, well, he is part of the triangle with Maguire and Stones. So you get a triangle with Rice. And then Bellingham would drop in the right side to try and help out and offer a pass out when they were trying to build from the back. But then Mount was staying up for like higher up the pitch with Kane and maybe Saka. And then USA just had them, everyone else locked down. So everyone else they were tight to and they couldn't get the ball into them. It was really a cleverly coordinated press. And then England just kept passing back to try and draw USA out a bit so they might be able to get a ball into someone like Mount. But as soon as Mount got the ball, bang, someone's tight to him.
Yeah.
And the ball has to go back. So they were just really careful. They don't want to risk those passes anymore.
A good note here is that we watched this game with illustrator Alice, who's relatively new to watching football regularly. And she commented that it was almost as though in these moments the USA had 13 players on the pitch.
Yeah, I think because they were at certain points, I didn't watch it looking for their press in mind. I'm sure John McKenzie did, but I think they were man-to-man at certain points, but basically they were just making sure they knew the ball would go to certain areas so they could then lock that down and keep the ball where they wanted it to. And then when England didn't get forward, they didn't commit many players in the final third because they didn't want to open up any space for a counter-attack.
Yeah.
And when they counter-attacked, they had Pulisic, Wright, Weah, McKennie would be part of that. The Musa and Adams following up. Sometimes one of the fullbacks would join in and it was all really well coordinated. I agree with it being the tactical battle won by the USA, but I also think that Southgate I don't think he really cared. I think they had, in a weird way, control of the game, but not doing it. And people like Phil Foden, you bring him on to try and bring him back into this. You put Foden on at any point in this game, he'll receive in tight areas, try and dribble past a couple players because he might get through and score that goal for you. Or he might be the one that can open up the pack defence, but he's also the one that might get tackled and then the ball turns over and they go up there.
JJ, I have a question. Sorry, there, Joe. I can't remember a time in the game when England attacked with more than four players.
Yeah.
That was so disappointing. I think one of the best things the US did during the game was kind of take away Bellingham as a threat. Everywhere he went, there was pressure on him. Never saw him have an impact in the box, really. And yet, anytime England crossed the halfway line, I was kind of desperate for them just to stop, build a phase, set up, and create some kind of crossing or passing angle, or at least a little bit of territorial dominance. And it never happened.
There were
at
a few moments in the first half, after about 10 minutes or 15 minutes, it felt like there was a moment, JJ, where you said, oh, England are going to score soon. That's what it feels like.
It felt inevitable.
Because there were one or two moves in a row where Saka particularly, I think, was able with one-twos to get through into the box.
Well, that was it. They were doing things like they were spinning a ball into one person who'd lay it off into another first time. So it was like a ball from maybe Mount into Kane, laying it off first into Sterling, or a ball straight into Saka, maybe from Rice, and then he'd lay it off into Kane, who put it first time into Sterling, or other way around, Sterling to Kane to Saka, something like that. Quick combinations, one-touch passing, that pulls teams apart. It's why Spain are really good at creating chances in these tight areas, because the tempo is fast to stretch them out. When you've got a team who sits back, when the USA would go back into their block, it would very much be a 4-4-2, Pulisic slightly further forward. But they're trying to condense it, so the ball has to go wide, then the ball goes out to someone like Shaw, and then the only option is to put the ball in the box for a header. Even magical captain Harry Kane can't score a header in this congested box, so that doesn't work. So then they just keep it, and they recycle it. It's that horseshoe thing that John was talking about. You know, you go back, you keep it safe, you are defensively sound because you're not giving the opposition the ball, and you're also defensively sound because you're not leaving yourself vulnerable to the counterpunch, which is exactly what the USA want to do.
Yeah. Well, it's worth saying, I listened to the Athletic Football podcast this morning, and they were saying on that they were giving Gareth Southgate the credit insofar as he is a manager who, you know, the last thing you can say of him is that he will underestimate an opponent at a tournament. I mean, clearly, like, the way that England set up today showed a great deal of respect to what the USA team is able to do. That they didn't attack very many opportunities with more than four players also shows what they believe can be done to them on the counter-attack. And also, it's 0-0, and they've essentially qualified without having to do anything.
It reminds me of the Euros when they drew with Scotland. It was very much the same to me, very much. They knew it was a tough opponent who'd be super pumped up for it. Like, you knew USA would be up for this one, right into it, and they'd have all the aggression. I was saying to, I can't remember who I was talking to earlier, but you can't really manufacture that motivation.
Yeah.
England are much better than the USA. They have much better players. They've got more, you know, success historically, blah, blah, blah. They're better on FIFA, all these things.
You wouldn't know it from today.
Well, you know. But then that's the thing. USA really hyped up because they want to beat England. They really do. And they've got the tactics all right, the motivation right, and the players all played really well. England's touch were a little bit loose now and again.
Yeah.
So you've got that sort of motivation going against you. Same with Scotland, really pumped up. Like, 0-0 counted as a win for Scotland in that tournament. It really did. And England were poor in that game. And I, looking back on it now, with retrospect, I think they didn't care because they knew if they got a point out of that, they'd more than likely be through anyway.
Sure.
So it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm sure we'll talk more about Gareth Southgate and what people think of him in the future.
It's clever tournament management is what I think it is.
Yeah.
I'm trying to give him a bit of credit.
No, I think that's right. I think that's right.
I do agree. I just think that if you want to sell that to the public, you then have to actually go and win the tournament at the end of it, because otherwise it feels very unfulfilling.
No, of course he is. I don't know. I think that's a bit over the top. Like, no, they've got to a semi-final in the last World Cup. They've got to the final in the Euros. That's further than they've been for decades. I think that's like,
I do agree, but right. I also think this is the richest talent pool they've had in decades too. Maybe if not ever, I think that
what
in
about
terms
the golden
of
boys?
What about the golden generation,
all the gold.
I
think
remember
of the gold.
All that gold.
The golden generation were a quarterfinal team, and this group of players I think is better. I think I'm a Gareth Southgate fan. I'm just trying to explain why the negativity exists.
You better be.
I know, but I think the problem becomes like. England now, you may get further, but the trade-off in tournaments is this kind of performance. And okay, maybe they're conserving energy. Maybe this is in a way a reaction to the amount of football some of these players have played. Well, maybe, but there's plenty of American players who are playing Europe too. And I also, it's very difficult to kind of rationalize because you always have these little questions. We've talked about Phil Foden, for instance. We've talked about how marginalized Bukayo Saka was. We talked about the lack of effect that Jude Bellingham was able to exert on this game. And I feel like it's a very reduced form of some of these players. And
absolutely, but they qualified.
If they qualify, fantastic. And if they go and win games and get far in tournaments, fantastic. I just think the journey for a lot of people is a little bit of a slog. And that's why there is a little bit of pushback.
Well, speaking of the journey, Chris, I can't let you come on this podcast without me as a British person asking you about soccer in America, because I'm obsessed with it. I love the idea of its growth over there. And I'm curious to hear from a US perspective. Firstly, what's the coverage been like of the World Cup? Does it feel like more people than normal are interested in soccer right now?
It's tough. This having a World Cup tournament over Thanksgiving and close to Christmas, where The sports calendar is basically a slog of NFL and NBA games. I think it's a tough sell. And I think honestly, the time slots benefit this US team. Obviously, they get primetime spots for all of their group stage matches. I think that will help. But oddly enough, I think much of the media coverage, guys, has really been tailored towards spinning it forward to 2026, when this group of really talented players will be able to play on home soil or in Mexico or Canada, mm-hmm. you know, basically home soil in North America, and be able to reach kind of that quote unquote potential that this group believes. And I think a lot of, you know, US soccer followers believe can be reached. But it hasn't necessarily been to the likings of, you know, I think for me, kind of the gold standard of, oddly enough, of, you know, media coverage for a U.S. men's national team World Cup was 2014 in Brazil, when there was, you know, oddly a lot of hype because of, you know, it was kind of like the last gasp of that generation. Landon Donovan had been left off in a shocking result by Jurgen Klinsmann. The U.S. was in that quote unquote group of death with Ghana, Portugal and Germany. But this year has been odd because it's a hard sell during this jam packed sports calendar here. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily know these young players, and they haven't fallen in love with them over several cycles the way they had with your Clint Dempsey's and Landon Donovan's and Michael Bradley's. I think so many people have PTSD after what happened in Trinidad and Tobago in 2017, to be honest with you. And I think, you know, the fact that this team has shown decently well so far, I mean, let's call it what it is. They've scored one goal in two matches, and they held England, you know, scoreless today, which is an accomplishment, I think. But I do think if you look at the grand scheme of things, this is a team that I think is still being sold to the public from a media perspective, because they haven't necessarily achieved anything major yet in order for the people to rightly buy into them.
Yeah, yeah. And so in terms of the team themselves, are there big plans ahead of 2026? Is there an idea of where they want the team to be by that point? Is there, presumably the idea is that they want to grow the popularity of soccer in the nation between now and then, and that might sort of reach a peak?
I think so. I think that you look at this youth movement that the men's national team has undergone since the failures of the 2018 World Cup qualifying cycle. I think they're in the right frame of mind. You see so many young American players playing in Europe where they need to be playing. And I think you saw the quality today. I mean, there were so many times when England had the U.S. pinned back, and previously when the U.S. would try to play out of the back against teams that were much better than him, he kind of grimaced because you were afraid that maybe a 1-2 wasn't going to go off, or a counter press was going to able to strip a defender that would lead to a quick chance. The U.S. have the quality to be able to hang with some of these teams now. I think for them, it's just a matter of taking it up a notch. And by that, I mean, you know, having enough talent to win a group in 2026, as opposed to scratching and clawing for second place where they traditionally have found themselves, which kind of goes back to, you know, your discussion of, you know, the way England set themselves up. I thought is kind of a dangerous way to approach it. If you're the alpha of the group, which I imagine England to be, which I believe England to be, is, you know, you go out, you seem to kind of be content with a draw today, but this is a crazy sport. And who knows if Gareth Bale, you know, waves goodbye to a rival the way Gareth Bale can do. And maybe Wales draws with England. And who knows? The fact that Iran can win the group if they beat the U.S. and England is held to a deadlock with Wales is insane to me. So this is a long tangent, but I just think like the U.S. need to get to a place, I think, where come 4 years from now, they can comfortably be able to compete with the powers of the world and not necessarily consider themselves that quote unquote underdog, because that's a cliche that I think a lot of fans have been tired of for a while now.
I think also that we said this after the USA's first game against Wales in this tournament, that in terms of the performances so far this tournament, that's gone. Like they've just been a good team in the group, and that's quite nice to see. Before I let you go, absolutely. Gio Reyna, lots of questions in the chat about Gio Reyna. Why is Gio Reyna not starting, do you think?
I think going back to our conversation about Phil Foden, I think a lot of what we talked about, what Foden does or could potentially do for an English team, I think you can apply that to the way Reyna plays within this U.S. setup. Not to mention the fact that he is a supremely talented player that unfortunately finds himself injured so supremely often that it is absurd that, I mean, it is a great thing that he managed to get himself into this group and be able to be fit and to play. But he is a player that traditionally just has been very hard to rely on because of injury questions and injury concerns, especially during his time at Dortmund. As we saw in the last friendly against Saudi Arabia in September, you know, I think he played 40, 45 minutes and then immediately felt something in the hamstring and had to, you know, signal to the bench. That is a concern, especially for such a young player. But it is an interesting question. And I think I haven't been able to watch Greg Berhalter's post-game press conference today. I'm sure he was asked about that. But it is very confounding if you think of a player of his talent and caliber, regardless of his injury concerns. If he's on the team, if he's in your match day squad, you believe him to be a player that can make a difference. And the fact that the U.S. played 173 minutes before implementing him into a match, I think is very interesting. And I think when you look back on the complexion of Greg Berhalter's tenure, as you guys know, national team managers, it all boils down to how you manage a squad at a World Cup. Mm. And if the U.S. don't manage to go through, if Gio plays limited minutes against Iran and it doesn't have an impact, I can't help but wonder what that will matter for Greg's kind of legacy in terms of turning this whole project around while also not being able to find a spot for a player who, you know, routinely starts for one of the best teams in the Bundesliga.
Yeah. Okay, fine. But just before I let you go, Chris, who's your favorite for the tournament?
I told my friends I really like this Brazil squad, and oddly enough, I don't have that much of a problem with Neymar missing matches because I think this team is deep enough. And I think Brazil so often kind of falls victim to what Portugal falls victim to with over-reliance on a player like Cristiano Ronaldo. I think Brazil can kind of get that way with Neymar. Now, Neymar is one of the top five players in the world. I'm not disputing his quality. But if you look at the way this Brazil team can play when they can be so free flowing and not necessarily rely on one player or a player that, and you guys know, a player that can start matches by so many fouls and so many, you know, dives. I think this Brazil team has the quality and just they're a fun team to watch. And I think for me, this Brazil team has what it takes to win the title, but it's difficult. Brazil's always struggled in World Cups away from South America, and it's been 20 years since they won. Or wait, 98 was it? Yeah. Not 2002. Yeah, so 98. I mean, that's 24 years. It's been a very long time. No, so
they won in 2002, Brazil. So
oh, was it 2002? Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So but a long did. Time, far too long for a country with that kind of footballing culture, no doubt.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. Chris Camerani, thank you very much for joining us today. Much appreciate that.
Cheers, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, and, Chris.
We'll go to a break now. When we come back, we'll do a little bit more England, and then we'll talk about the other games of the day.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Okay, for England, JJ, going into the final game against Wales, not a bad position to be in, of course, because I think, as ITV said, unless they lose 4-0 or more, they have qualified, you know, which is ideal because you'd expect that Wales will be up for that game.
Against England. Yes, I think they'll be up for that one, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the next game then. See, I was just keeping them in to get them past the ad break, you know, so they could carry on thinking there was going to be more. It's not because I thought there'd be more. It's because I was just using it as a tool to get people to keep. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well played.
For them to roll over past the ad break and for them to. Again, it's not that I thought there'd be more to discuss. It's that I thought it was going to be, you know, Wales 0-2 Iran. That was a cracker, wasn't it, Seb? That was a really exciting game.
Yeah, I think it's probably as involved as I've been in any game this tournament. We watched it together. It was very gripping. It's one of those games which, during the course of the 90 minutes, you see little themes emerge. And over time, they kind of build and build and build and a kind of crescendo winner, as the Stadio boys would describe it, I guess. But I was so impressed with Iran. I remember we sat down to watch it, and just before, well, whilst the Iranians were singing their national anthem, on the big screen, they showed an elderly man who just burst into tears. Uh-huh. And can't speculate on why, but obviously he was in, was having a difficult time of it. It was a very affecting moment. I remember thinking, if Iran are able to extricate themselves from this situation with the players singing their national anthem, and I don't think it's unfair to say that they seem conflicted whilst doing so.
Yes.
And all the chatter, the humiliation of conceding 6 goals in their first game to England, and then to come and produce a performance like that was just outstanding.
They played with it with an aggression, didn't they? With a kind of a fierceness in this game.
An aggression, but also a class. Yeah. I thought that what I was expecting was, I think resiliency is one aspect of a team performance. And very often when you face adversity, you're galvanized into, you know, right, lads, let's prove people wrong, stand behind the ball, make sure we don't give anything away, fine. But also they played ever so well up front. So
Sardar Azmoun was spectacular.
Yeah, well, also Sardar Azmoun, he played, I think it's fewer than 300 Bundesliga minutes this season, which is not very many. He's barely played any football. I think he lasted about 68 minutes of this game. He was absolutely excellent.
He was down 3 times.
He was down 3 times. Yeah. 2 of those were for cramp, and somehow they kind of stuck him back together with gaffer tape and got him going again. But he was great. His battle with Joe Roden, I thought, was one of the sort of the little conflicts of the game.
It was really interesting, particularly.
Yeah, Roden played very well, but also in the second half, Azmoun raced away, hit the post in that kind of bizarre sequence when they hit the post twice within 30 seconds. And I thought Taremi was great. We know Taremi because of his Champions League performances and his form for Porto, but his combinations with Azmoun were a delight, actually, in the way that Iran brought players into their attack when they were going forward. Exactly what we were just criticizing for not doing earlier, about 10 minutes ago, Iran were very, very good at, and they were too good for Wales.
I suppose two different reactions from a win and a loss in the first round. Understandable, I suppose, isn't it? We'll come back to talk about Iran a little bit more. But JJ, Wales were poor in the game.
Wales were awful.
What went wrong for them?
I think we're supposed to say that they tried really hard, so that's good, and they ran a lot, but they were dreadful. Their first touch was terrible.
Yeah, it was close. You know, it was closer in the first half, but there were indications all the way through, albeit a bit more subtly than in the second half, that Iran were dominating the game. Wales just... they just never got hold of it.
Just, it looks so poor. Too much depth between the back line and the forward line, I think. Moore and Bale. I mean, Bale was even playing. Do you have any touches apart from at the end? I don't remember.
Did you think when you saw the team sheet and you saw Keith Moore and you thought, that's going to suit Bale a little bit more than playing with Dan James? And his level of involvement, if anything, was less.
Honestly, not really. I didn't think it would make a difference.
Really?
Okay. He just doesn't do anything. He's doing like a bit like what Ronaldo does, where he's just there for the moments when they happen, but then he's a passenger the rest of the time. He's not putting pressure on anyone. He's not winning the ball back. He's not really doing anything to bring the team up the pitch. The first touch of almost everyone, apart from maybe like Harry Wilson, was really poor. Ampadu was rushing things in possession. Mm. Aaron Ramsey looked exactly as bad as he's been for the Rangers the last while. I've not watched him play at all in France, so I don't know how well he's getting on there.
I haven't seen him much.
But he was not good at Rangers. It doesn't look like, he's not at all the same player he was that we remember from Arsenal. Which this is a long time ago.
He's not that old. Aaron Ramsey is 31, I think.
They've all dropped off. Bale's not the same. Like they're all dropped off a little bit. I mean, the things we're bad at are tactically, I thought they were really poor. And then also seeing Cam in possession, playing through lines, they had none of that. So they were just hoofing it long, not able to keep up with it. And they were leaving gaps at the back that Iran were just running straight through. Iran looked so much better. I thought Azmoun in particular was really, really good.
Athletically, that's an amazing performance.
He had a good game as well. I thought. And Golazadeh as well had a good game on the right side with his lovely left foot. But yeah, I thought, so in research for all the World Cup games, I thought Iran looked really good. And so I was surprised that they got done in by England in that game. But we speculated why that might have been the last one of the other podcasts that we did. Wales are, they're out now, aren't they? Well, no, they can still win.
Technically they could still qualify if there's a draw between Iran and between the USA, and if they win by I guess enough goals.
I think it's more than four goals. If they beat England by more than four goals, then they can.
That's just the scenario that England qualify in. At the moment, like Iran are currently on 3 points. If they drew with the USA, the USA would also be on 3 points. Iran would be on four. Wales would be on four if they beat England. It's just a case of goal difference, and they would almost naturally go through immediately because Iran shipped six goals. So if they win and there's a draw in the other game,
so I think that would make still it, the opportunity. If they could beat England by three goals, then yes, I'm just looking at the table now. Yeah, so they would need to probably score at least three goals.
I don't think so, because the competition is against Iran, who conceded six. I'm pretty sure from a goal difference perspective.
But if the USA were to beat Iran, I mean,
if the USA beat Iran, then Wales can't go through.
Regardless, they've got to score goals.
Let's not do maths live on the live stream because we can't do it. I think the idea is if Wales win and there's a draw in the other game, then they're more than likely to go through.
The point is to be able to score goals. They've got to play in a different way to create chances to do that. Yeah. And I don't know how they want to create chances.
Well, their only goal so far has come from a penalty.
I don't see what their chance creation is, though. Are they relying on these wing backs, Nico Williams and Conor Roberts, getting up the pitch?
Roberts' delivery from wide seems to be a really important part of things.
There's no pressure on people. There's no aggression.
Williams is like, I don't like Williams on the left. I don't think it works quite as well. Roberts put in one really good ball in the first half, and that was probably as close as Wales really got. Apart from there was a Kiefer Moore header from a Roberts cross in the first, which Hosseini saved. Other than that, I'm struggling to think of any clear opportunities they created.
There was a chance earlier, wasn't there, with Moore went flying.
That's the one from Roberts. Yeah. I think that came in from wide. Yeah.
Yeah, like, to really, so disappointing with Wales. I thought it'd be much better. I thought they'd have a real go at it.
Well, let's look further ahead than this group and this tournament and talk about Wales more generally. Because at the moment, it's kind of unclear what kind of team they will become. The star players of Gareth Bale, we mentioned Aaron Ramsey, although I was surprised to hear that he is only 31. Joe Allen, if we can include him, they won't be at the next World Cup. It's very unlikely that they will. Mm-hmm. So what does the future look like for Wales? I mean, are there good players coming through that can help maintain their FIFA rankings, or do you think they're going to recede again?
I don't think you can replace what Bale has been and what Ramsey was, maybe not what Ramsey is right now, but a really, really good player at his best. Roden is still quite young. Mepham too. And so, Roberts and Williams.
Mepham too? Is he the one that comes after Mepham 1?
He's even better.
He's
taller.
If there's a direct replacement.
That Chris Mepham is now.
That's brilliant.
He has features you don't really want, though, but it arguably does make him better.
Right.
There's also, he has another smaller two-tailed fox that hangs around with him.
Right.
All the time.
Okay.
So sometimes when he loses the ball, the fox picks it up, which is useful at times.
Handball.
Yeah.
Wales have quite an interesting generation in the wings. So we've seen a little bit of Brennan Johnson playing for Nottingham Forest. I think most people would describe him as a pretty good player. Ben Cabango, the Swansea City defender. Silver Thomas, who is at Huddersfield, who I think if you haven't seen much Huddersfield, but you managed to catch the playoff final between Huddersfield and Nottingham Forest last season, he's a very good player. Attached to a really good story. His rise through the game has been excellent. Good set piece taker. Ampadu is still there. Like Harry Wilson is in his almost coming to his mid-20s. Conor Roberts, Nico Williams, these are not old players. They will have another few tournament cycles in them.
Yeah.
So it's not that. It's not that it's all or nothing now. You just wonder.
I disagree. I think it is.
But knowing what, this is the thing, like knowing what you do about Wales' qualification for not just this tournament, but the Euros in 2016, you remember the moments from Gareth Bale, really. Yeah. And you remember that when it mattered, he was the one that created something or did something. He was a talisman. And ultimately, like from a social perspective, I think being able for some of these players to be able to play with someone like Gareth Bale, he's got like a million European Cups under his belt now, is very, very important. Same for Aaron Ramsey. He's played at the top of the game for a very long time. And so when you step on the pitch as a young player, so as a young Joe Roden or a Conor Roberts or a Nico Williams or whoever, you don't have the inferiority that you might do if you didn't have that star in your midst. And I think that's a very difficult thing to replace. And it's also from an opposition standpoint, we were talking about England, Wales a little bit earlier, and you would fancy England because player for player, they're better. But the one kind of the leveling factor is what if Bale XXXXX, what happens next? Well, there's an ellipsis there because he may not be mobile. He may not be kind of the incendiary player that he was at Spurs and Real Madrid all those years ago, but he can still produce something in an isolated moment. And without that, all of a sudden the opposition is a little bit less to fear and can play in a slightly different way. So it's very difficult. And a player like Gareth Bale comes along once in a generation.
Well, I guess you just got to cross your fingers for Bale too.
Bale 2, Bale squared.
Bale 2 is meant to be quite good.
Yeah.
Can I say on a serious note before we move on from Wales, I missed this news yesterday. I only saw this morning, but I was a bit disappointed with Rob Page, the Wales manager, isn't he?
Yeah.
Robert,
yeah.
I was a bit disappointed with his comments pre-game related to Germany and how Germany might be retrospectively a bit disappointed that their players took a stance against the one love armband thing as a, you know, because of the result. I'm not certain that there'll be any correlation between those two things, but I also don't think, whilst we have said in this podcast before, there is no expectation from us that players or managers do say something. I think there is an expectation that they don't say that, right? Is that not fair?
Yeah, I didn't understand his comments. I think we covered it in the podcast that night. Germany lost because they have technical flaws and they're well established, and all the weaknesses they have were really well exploited by Japan.
Sure.
That they chose to protest before the game has nothing to do with anything, really.
And if your personal opinion as a manager is that keeping your players focused on the football as much as possible is the best thing to do, then by all means do that, but just don't say that.
Yeah, I would need to hear more. Obviously, it would be good to hear a justification or explanation for why he thinks that. But it wasn't a great moment, I don't think.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Iran, JJ. Iran, brilliant position in the group now. Draw probably suited them better than it suited Wales, but of course a win is even better. I was writing this as the game was going on. Thoughts on Iran, JJ? Jahanbash is suspended. It's unclear whether Sardar Azmoun will be injured for the next game or not. It's not going to be an easy one.
For Iran?
Yes.
No, probably not. I think there's no easy games in the World Cup, though, is there?
No.
Iran are decent, so I like them.
Sure.
And they play nice football. And like I said before, Azmoun is a very nice, tidy player. They have some technically good players. They also played with a lot more aggression and tactical cohesion in the game against Wales, but Wales were dreadful.
Yeah.
So I think Iran hit that little phase where they hit the post like twice or something like that.
Twice in 30 seconds, and then they had that chance which Hennessy smothered at his near post.
Yeah, so, and then Hennessy went and booted the boy into outer space and sent off. Yeah.
And then all the pundits were like, I'm not sure that was a red card.
The referee gave it a yellow.
It was extraordinary.
I kind of like, what are you thinking?
It's a red card in so in many different ways. He kicks him in the head. He's late. He's got his... Yeah. He's
the goalkeeper.
Endangering an opponent. He's the goalkeeper. And he's probably the last man.
No, I've got nothing specific against Jurgen Klinsmann, but immediately after the game in the punditry, Jurgen Klinsmann seemed to spend the entire time talking about how Iran just did fouls constantly and were in the referee's ear the whole game. I remember thinking, did we watch the same game? Even if that did happen, they were so much better.
Yeah, but I think that's part of what they did. They didn't do against England was snap into tackles, like do all the tactical fouling stuff where they're horrible to play against. They weren't like, so you didn't have Van Perdue receive the ball, someone's on him straight away. If the ball goes to Wilson, someone's on him straight away. And it's, you're going through the back of them. So it's those really frustrating fouls that break the game up.
Yeah.
Wales could never really get passes going because they were getting broken up. So then they'd have to play really slow phases. They turned it into like a turn-based game rather than a free-flowing RPG. It was more civilization than Age of Empires,
sure,
for example. And they made it that way because they're better at Civ.
Yeah.
So then Iran beat them at Civ. They got a, I don't know, domination victory. I've got bored of the analogy.
Sure. Okay. Well, in which case, let's move on and quickly discuss it. The Netherlands won 1 Ecuador, Seb. Ecuador, another example of a team, rather a bold underdog in this tournament.
Really enjoyed watching Ecuador in this. Ordinarily, and I don't know if this is true or whether it's something that I've imagined from the past, but I've always thought underdogs at World Cup level, they tend to play in kind of roughly the same way, which is that they sit behind the ball, they play on the counter. Now, the cliff notes on Ecuador heading into this tournament were really good in transition, and they're exactly as advertised, to be fair. But I think what surprised me is the intricacy of their football and the expression within it. So... for the first 60 minutes especially, they were full of little flicks and their little third man runs, like really well constructed play, and it's nice to see. It's like we've talked about inferiority before on this podcast, but it's nice to see, like, actually that technical confidence. I think that's probably the best way to describe it. It's same with the USA. We talked about how in tournaments past, they didn't quite trust the ball out of defense, or they thought maybe, well, let's play that long or into a channel because we don't want our six getting it. We don't really want him having the ball there. Mm. And that's kind of gone now. I think Ecuador is the same. This is a really good group of players. Like the left-hand side, particularly like Hincapié and Estupiñán. I think that's a superb left side, and it's going to be together for a very long time as well, which is
how
great.
How do you say his name? Because I kind of want to say it like Estupiñán, but is that wrong?
I don't know if I'm right. I go with Estupiñán. I don't know if that's correct. I've heard that on commentary.
Estupiñán, I think.
Estupiñán. Estupiñán.
Estupiñán.
Wouldn't the N have a cedilla if it was Ña in Spanish?
I don't know.
No? Okay. It's been a long
time. I feel like I'm
time.
Saying it like he's French, and I know that's wrong.
Okay. Either way, great player.
Yeah.
But I was so impressed, and I Plata also had a really, really good game. We know Casado from Brighton, obviously. And hey, JJ, you were talking about, we were having a conversation about him in the middle of the game. And I thought he was he's going to become a really, really excellent player. And you think he's already at his peak?
I think he already
Explain
is a good player.
Yourself.
Well, I think basically, technically, you're basically the same footballer you'll always be when you're about 18, 19, 20.
Oh, no. I thought I was going to get better.
No, maybe I think there was time for you because you haven't evolved any of your attributes. So technically you are all at once. So yeah, I think there was room for you.
What about my mental game? Hi.
It's definitely a mental game. Yeah. So Casado is 21, right? So like his manager, both his last managers, De Zerbi now and Potter before, has said things about how he is basically, you know, top level, off and on the ball. I think he's already a very, very good player. What I mean with this technical thing, obviously there'll be things you improve on and you can work on in training, but technically he's the player he is. What you can see is that he can play at a really high level at such a young age. So when you put him into a bigger team, which he can definitely play at, you can see how good he is now.
Yeah.
He will look better because he's surrounded by other players who are even better. And that'll be nice. And I like that. So it sounds like I'm trying to be dismissive and say that he's not going to get any better. It's more that he's already good. One of the things annoying me is like he's not got a high rating in FIFA yet. I don't know why I'm talking about FIFA again. I hardly even play it.
What is his rating in FIFA?
It's like 79 or 80 or something like that. But he should be like an 83, 84.
Okay.
Something like that. But then because his potential would be that.
Okay.
And so you might have that happening later.
I think there's a general point here is when we're talking about underdogs, I think if you think of all the underdog performances that we've seen in this tournament so far, successful or otherwise, they've all been kind of different.
Mm.
Like there have been some similarities in that we talked about the aggression that was familiar between the kind of the Tunisian team and the Saudi Arabian side. Sure. But we've also seen interesting tactical details. So like high line, we talked about kind of expressive football, talked about kind of physical football. There's the full rainbow of like approaches to sort of taking down a sort of a favored side. And I don't think there's a vast gap between the Netherlands and Ecuador, but there is a significant one,
yeah,
like historically. But it's just so nice to see because it means that when you tune into a game, you don't quite know what you're about to watch. And that's just a real positive in any football tournament, obviously.
That's right, Seb. Let's talk about Frenkie de Jong now.
Right.
Because Frenkie de Jong got a bit of criticism after this game. So yeah, says Seb Stafford Bloor. What happened there?
Well, the criticism didn't come from Seb Stafford Bloor. He just noted the criticism.
You just noted the
I
criticism.
I observed the criticism and I put it in the podcast plan.
And you observed it and you reacted to it.
Yeah, I personally felt he's a little bit slow with the ball, a little bit.
Because JJ, I like this because JJ thinks something different. And okay, I thought you guys could have like a kind of
an argument,
a conversation. No.
A battle to the death.
Yes. A battle to the death, yeah. A
fight in the streets.
That's right.
I wouldn't have Seb would batter me in a fight in the streets, but I feel like in the office I could...
You're an elusive and smart.
I think if I knew it was happening, I'd be all right. But
yeah, you are devious.
Yeah. I think if you just started on the outside, I think it'd be ended. Anyway, Frenkie de Jong, I like him. So what he's doing for the Netherlands, I'm going to show this on the board for people who are listening on the podcast, right? What he does is he picks up the ball from deep and he carries it. So Netherlands go from being a defensive little team into the attacking section of the pitch. I'm quite tired. So that's what he does. But what he was doing was a lot in this game was that the Netherlands weren't, they were leaving themselves really open. So the wing backs were going really high and wide and leaving loads of space. And then the centre backs, you know how Liverpool look really disjointed quite a lot at the moment. So like Van Dijk looks very, right? So it looks very much like that. Van Dijk and Timber and Aki were very loose from each other. So they, Joe's making faces at me just so you know if you're listening to this. So what you have is them looking very separate from each other. And who were playing against Ecuador, were able to take advantage of that, and they were looking really dangerous, and that's how whenever Valencia scored his goals and whatever. But what's happening was that De Jong noticed that and was trying to slow it down and calm things down. So he was taking the ball, and then rather than spray it, to say like Ecuador pushed up, right, and they had other players pushing forward because they changed their shape, Ecuador, to match Netherlands. So when they had someone like maybe Bergwijn or, I don't know, Gakpo or whoever was trying to get in behind, De Jong might have had the option to play a ball in to, especially Dumfries actually, who's trying to run on the outside. So Dumfries is trying to make a run on the outside of his man to get into space. De Jong had the ball and he would have seen it, but rather than play that ball, he was trying to slow it down. So actually he may have been able to put the team through, but the whole point was that he was trying to slow it down so they can get back into shape, get their rest defense that John McKenzie likes a lot. And he is correct, because then what would happen is that they would be able to have a better defensive shape to be able to stop all the chances they were conceding. So it looked like De Jong was kind of stopping them being an attacking threat and making them less interesting to watch, but he was just trying to control the game, and that's what good players do.
Do you have a retort?
Well, firstly, I'm a very gentle person. Like, I'm a very mild-mannered, you know.
Are you still talking about the fight?
I wanted to address that first, yes.
Right.
Of course I did.
He's doing what we do and bringing the bit up. It's funny, because what I did was boring.
Right.
I didn't want to leave that hanging in the air as a kind of, you know.
About your toxicity.
No, there's nothing toxic about me.
I like it, because normally Seb would respect the boring bit and not acknowledge it was boring.
Not but sure.
He's
a very clever change of direction.
He's allowing...
You are clever, aren't you?
To dismiss things I'm saying now, and I like that. Yeah. It means I'm accepted.
Why did David Klaassen play? Because, I asked that because...
No.
Because...
Is this actually going to be interesting?
Yes, it is. Because...
Hold, before you start.
Yeah.
Chat, wait until Seb's finished, and then let's have an answer from JJ. And once we're done, we'll come back to the chat for reviews out of 10 of how interesting this is.
Okay.
And then the chat will decide.
Okay, so I understand pushing Cody Gakpo into the forward line alongside Steven Bergwijn. That's fine. But when you put Klaassen in there, does that replicate what Gakpo is able to provide in terms of like creativity, goal-scoring threat, but also the ability to carry the ball too? That feels a little bit lopsided to me.
Well, no, he's a different player. So the whole point of this 5-2-1-2, it's exactly the same system that Scotland play. So what you need to have is two players who can work the channels. So what you often get is like... something that will happen like this. So Bergwijn will move out to the wing. If I can draw an arrow, I'll draw an arrow. He can draw it to the wing. And then when he does that, it means that someone like Blind can underlap. It's actually more common on the right because you've got Denzel Dumfries who underlaps when they go out wide. So you've got your wide player and you still have a player who underlaps. Dumfries is very involved in the attacking phase. Now Klaassen is essentially like a 9.5/10. But when they're attacking, he can join in to arrive in the box late, a bit like Roberto Firmino and that sort of thing. But what you also get is when they're trying to press, it looks like a 2, but actually it's a 1 or a 3 if they push Klaassen forward. So they've got a front 3. You've got Klaassen can put pressure to show the ball either side. If it goes this side of a defender, it goes to the defender's left side, the ball will then be shown to the right. And then Bergwijn can come across, show it to the wide to the other person out in the wing. And then that's a trap. And they can cross, squeeze up and win the ball that way. But Klaassen just does, he's just good tactically. He's a solid footballer. He's not the same as other ones because he's a different kind of player. But it works tactically.
But you're asking him to be both like a pivot and a goal scorer in that
system. It's not a pivot though. He's just there to be part of a press and to help link. You're not putting everything through him. It's so he can arrive in late. I mean, Scotland, I think the person that plays it normally is like Stuart Armstrong, John McGinn would do it. They're not pivots either. They're just players who can help with the press, but also link in the final third and just arrive in places to finish up.
I just consider Armstrong to be a more athletic player than someone like Klaassen. I don't rate him. I just prefer him as a kind of, almost as an 8. I just think it's more effective when he's got something ahead of him that's actually central. You need all the pieces around him. I understand that. You need the creation of the overlaps. Definitely. I'm not allowed to use the board, so I can't illustrate it. But
you can use the board. I'm not touching it now.
No, you allow me to use the board, but
can use the board.
Him.
No, listen, the results in the chat so far are annoyingly positive.
Okay.
I think the chat wants to see you use the board.
I don't want him there. I want him behind, not Bergwijn, but someone like, for instance.
And the audio listeners now know why Seb's not allowed to use the board.
No.
I don't want him there.
I can deal with Gakpo playing this role because Gakpo's got the broader skill set, which allows him to be a goal threat all across this area. We've seen it in the Champions League, seen it in Holland. Like when Memphis is fit, like you could play him like that. But when you've got
someone, like what?
Oh, Oh, sorry.
My joke is that no one listening knows what you're talking about. You don't like him here or here or here.
Okay.
A clever animator would put in pictures of a fridge and then a forest.
I don't like Klaassen in any kind of Force 9 situation because he doesn't have the ability to do it. Like, he's not technically good enough for that role. He's not Roberto Firmino. So I want a player like Gakpo there. In that attacking midfield role, because he can score goals anywhere from within sort of 25 yards. He can also move into the box, as we saw in the first game. And also, like, you bring a Memphis and a Bergwijn in with him there, all of a sudden you have a versatility which I just don't think that Klaassen provides.
The reason is Gakpo can play as a winger as well. So you play Gakpo up top alongside Bergwijn, who's also a winger, and then what you get, I'll move them around here, is that they can both move into the channels that you want.
Moving around where?
Well, they both move the channels. It was like we want from your front two in the system.
You've got 12 players on there.
Yeah, yes. I brought on Memphis.
Seb's done something, and then
I brought him on. It's not an accident. There's 12 players.
I
on
want
the
to
board.
Finish off this Klaassen thing. Now, do you may recall David Klaassen from his days at Ajax, where he was very, very good, playing in exactly this role as a 10 behind forwards. Sometimes as a forward, he scored lots of goals. In fact, he scored 10 goals 1 year, and he scored... that was a different team. He scored 13 goals and 14 goals. He was so good, in fact, that Everton paid £23.5 million, according to the football manager I've got on screen in front of me right now. And that's what he did. He was that good. But then he was not very good
for a long time
at Everton at all. Because the role he plays there, he didn't either have the dynamism, like you're saying, nor really the technical, creative skill set to be able to do the things you want to do. He's just a good footballer that can play in that area. It's hard to work out kind of really what he is, but he is good.
Producer Don's yawning now.
Okay, we'll move on.
But I think you have broadly positive reviews I'm prepared to accept that this one's on me. Okay?
I look at the Dutch bench and there are just better options. I mean, not necessarily Vincent Janssen. I'm a Spurs fan. I know what Vincent Janssen is and I know what his limitations are. Wout Weghorst, that's a very interesting option. Like, it just confuses me, that's all.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Yeah.
It was a question rather than a statement.
Absolutely. I think it went fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you should use the board more.
I would like to. I'm not allowed to practice on it or use it. And when I try to be helpful, I did a helpful thing earlier in this episode when I switched two players that were wrongly positioned.
Oh.
No one noticed that.
No one thanked you for that.
Thanked me for that.
Well, thank you, Seb. Yeah, thank yous in the chat for Seb. Let's have a break now. Oh, Qatar won 3 Senegal.
You said underwater when you said that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, with bubbles in my mouth. Ish. Yeah. Qatar, first team eliminated, JJ. It's not a surprise. But it's presumably not what Qatar would have wanted.
Are you asking me, did Qatar want to go out of the group stages?
What I'm asking you is,
what a great question.
Look at this. Over a decade of the Aspire Academy, ex-Barcelona coach in charge, there were higher expectations than what has been.
Yes.
They were more underwhelming than I expected.
I think they wanted to do better than what they did.
Right, yeah.
But they lack many of the components required to have done that.
Right.
Such as composure, technical skill, and power.
Yeah. Okay.
Ultimate power.
Okay. Well, in which case, let's discuss Senegal, because, of course, they've got 3 points on the board now, which is setting up a winner-takes-all scenario between Senegal and Ecuador, something you predicted earlier on in the tournament, Seb. That's going to be a really exciting one, isn't it? Who takes it? A quick one here. Who takes it, Senegal or Ecuador?
Ecuador. Ecuador. I'm more impressed with Ecuador, I think.
What about you?
Who's better?
Well, who's going to win that game?
I started singing the Ecuador song in my head. I think Senegal.
You think Senegal?
Yes.
Okay. I'll be curious to know what John predicts for that when we get a little bit closer as well, the dividing vote. Fine. Listen, we are looking forward to that game. We'll talk about that a lot more. I think we've got to rush through to the next bit now. We'll talk about JJ's first round takeaways. You weren't here yesterday when the first round of games concluded, and I would now like to discuss your thoughts broadly on those games. Who do you like, JJ?
Who do I like? I like... Spain were really good.
They were good.
I can tell you like really quickly what I think of all of it.
Okay.
Do I have to tell you? Spain really great.
Great.
Qatar, Wales, Costa Rica dreadful. England very impressive in the first game. Seemed to have managed it fine in the second.
Yes.
Argentina tactically very poor. They need wingers.
Uh-huh.
Brazil decent. Germany should have been better. Japan.
Is this your audition for Ordinary Guy?
What's that? Ordinary guy
with normal opinions.
What's that?
It's just a role I've invented for the books. Oh, right.
I mean, obviously, I'm a top tier football analyst.
Yeah.
Morocco, Tunisia.
You're a top tier football analyst. So
Japan all surprised me, I wrote. Yeah. They all surprised me by how good they were. Because I watched a lot of teams before the World Cup. And let me tell you, Morocco, Tunisia, Saudi Arabia and Japan did not look good. No.
Mm.
Australia were about as good as I thought they'd be.
Yeah.
And Qatar were exactly as...
Well, that's almost all the teams, isn't it?
I know. I'm just trying to cover all bases.
Yeah.
Portugal were poor, especially with Ronaldo on the pitch.
Yeah.
He doesn't move much, but he did almost score. It's an odd...
He did score,
and I think it should have counted. So, yeah.
He did score, didn't he?
He scored a real goal. It's got a real goal. That doesn't count.
He scored an offside goal in the first
right.
Yeah. No, it wasn't offside. He nudged the boy off the ball.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, I fear that you've covered so many bases that all of my other questions are already answered.
You told me you were going to do this, and then I prepared.
Right. You prepared to destroy the segment in under 60 seconds. Give me one answer for this. One of your best answers, please, sir. Biggest surprise for you so far?
Biggest surprise.
Yeah.
Worst things that were surprising that happened.
Saudi Arabia beating Argentina.
Yeah, that's that one. That one. Yeah.
That was surprising.
I really didn't think that would happen.
Japan beating Germany.
I think it's Saudi Arabia, because Japan I can see happening because Germany sort of let that slip. And I think even though I agree with you that the Rudiger silly dance wasn't like him doing the funny run wasn't.
That was weird, wasn't it?
It wasn't why they lost or anything like that. Nothing to do with off pitch stuff. There's a certain level of assumption that they'd won the game. Whereas Saudi Arabia, having watched them, because I just couldn't figure out if they're good enough. And I remember in the other World Cup, they were quite fun to watch for 15 minutes, then they got beaten 5-0, basically.
And
a similar thing now. So they've got technically quite good players along the team, and I know how they play and what they do, and I thought they'd change a little bit for this tournament. And then the energy and the momentum they come out with in that second half was unbelievable. It was so, so impressive. And I wanted them to win by the end of it.
Yeah.
I really want Argentina to win for Messi. And I think that was the surprising part. And I don't even think it was that they were lucky. I think it was that they maximized the only possible way they could have won that game and played all the way to it. They did everything they could have done.
Yeah.
Because they're so much worse a team than Argentina, but they had better balance in that day and better aggression. And that's sometimes what all you need. I loved it.
It's quite a nice one for a World Cup, isn't it, really? Because there's a couple of things that come out of it. I mean, there was the video of all of the young Saudi fans dancing around to Free From Desire, which was quite fun. And also, we saw listeners to the podcast, Abdullah, outside our office.
One of our
today,
favorite listeners.
Had Abdullah. A quick chat. Yeah. Abdullah from Dubai, who referenced the fact that he had a number of friends at that game who were all overwhelmed with the result. I mean, it's quite a meaningful one for the Middle East, isn't it?
Yeah, it was nice. It was really interesting to hear Abdullah talk about it. It was... Yeah, I didn't really appreciate it from that perspective. And I don't think you can if you live outside of the Middle East. I don't know. I can't relate to what it would mean for that result to happen. But it was extraordinary. Have you seen the footage of the halftime team talk?
Yes, I have. Yeah,
it's extraordinary. Isn't
it? There's a bit of psychology that I like about it. Is he starts sitting with the players to be as one of them, be all these psychological tricks to play with them, so they're with him. Then he can stand up and start delivering it. What I thought was really good was the translator who was saying everything he was saying in exactly the same cadence. And rhythm, obviously a different language, to the players. Highlight was brilliant.
Yeah.
So that guy's just as important as the manager. He's relaying the actual information.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I was genuinely surprised by how good England looked in that first game as well, but I think that might also be Iran.
Hard to tell, isn't it? Yes. Hard to tell. Okay, fine. Well, listen, there'll be much more discussing of all of these teams. No one is eliminated yet until the next few days. Qatar. I forgot about Qatar. Yes. I'm sure we'll talk more about Qatar. The tournament is being hosted there after all. Let's do points about. Should we put our headphones back on and enjoy ourselves a song? Yes. Hit that play button, Don.
Bobby Charlton, Comb Over.
Oh, it's the remix.
It's the remix, JJ. Yes, there we go. What a lovely song. We can all take our headphones off. Good fade timing, Don. Yeah. Points of bad time. Okay, points of bad... it's time to discuss the points from yesterday. Now, there were some decent predictions yesterday. In fact, this has been one of our better days for overall points added, I can tell you. We have a still the same current leader, of course. It's JJ. He hasn't been overtaken. There weren't that many points in it today. You're not the leader of the day. Oh. You're the loser of the day.
Oh.
But you are the leader overall still. It was so tight. Our winner today was John McKenzie, who only added 7 points. Yeah, he had quite a good day.
Well done, John.
Seb and I did 8. I was sort of, I got in trouble after the final game. I was doing really well.
What did you predict?
3-1. So right, I added 4 points there. But I was only on 4 before the final
game.
That's
pretty good.
Pretty proud of that. And JJ Bull, you added 9 for the day. Your predictions there, including 2-1 USA. You had 2-0 for Netherlands, Ecuador. So that one was not that far off. But you had Qatar 4-0 Senegal. Not that far off. You managed to add 9 points.
I had Senegal 4.
Huh?
It was 0-4.
0-4, yeah, that's right, yeah. Anyway, so it, of course, goes to John to go last. JJ Bull, you get to do your picks first today. So let's begin with Tunisia-Australia, which is the first game of tomorrow.
I'm going to go with 1-0
Tunisia. 1-0
Tunisia.
Okay, yeah. That is good to know. Seb, you and I are next, so you can go next if you want.
I'll go 1-0 Australia.
You want a 1-0 Australia. That's a 0-1. Okay. Yeah. And I thought Tunisia were really good the other day. But Australia did score a goal, didn't they? I'm going to say 0-2 Australia. Very excited. Sorry. 2-0 Tunisia is what I meant to say. I don't know why I did that. And John's predictions here. John has 2-0 as his first choice. He's got 3-0 as his second choice to Tunisia. So we'll give him the 3-0 there. Okay.
In the 0-0 slot.
JJ, back to you. Poland, Saudi Arabia tomorrow.
1-0 Poland.
You want a 1-0 Poland. Okay, Seb?
0-0.
You think that's a 0-0? I think that's not a bad shout, given that Saudi Arabia probably be very happy with a draw out of that. I'm going to say 1-1.
A lot out of them in the Argentina games.
So, yeah, yeah, I'm going to go for a 1-1. John has 1-0 as his first. He's got 2-1 Poland as his second choice, so we'll give him a 2-1. JJ, France, Denmark.
2-1 to France.
2-1 to France. Okay. Seb Stafford, Blood, Denmark. We haven't seen much from them yet, have we?
1-1.
You think that's a 1-1?
Oh, that's better.
He likes it.
I think there's something in Denmark.
Do you?
Yeah, I do.
I'm going to go for a 1-0 France. And down below, John McKenzie sends us. He has 2-0 as his first option, which he can have to France. So he predicts no goals. That's all very tight here. We're at the stage now where the score predictions are so close that it's very difficult for there to be much lateral movement. So it's all ones here and there. The final game of the day, a cracker, Argentina-Mexico. JJ Bull, you get to go first. What do you think of this one?
1-0 to Argentina.
You think 1-0? I think that's not a bad shout, actually. They're desperate for a result after the first game. They'll be riding it tight. Seb Stafford-Bloor?
3-1 Argentina.
Oh, yeah. He's gone the other direction. I don't know. Oh, God, I don't know what to say. I'm going to go for 2-0 because I'm afraid. And John McKenzie says 3-0 to Argentina.
Okay.
All right. So I can tell you that the final scores, the grand totals so far at the end of day 6, I am in last place with 53 points. Now remember, points are bad. Seb Stafford-Bloor, you are on the second last place with 51 points. Points are bad. John is on 45 points, just 2 behind JJ.
So I'm winning.
In 43, you managed to lose the day because there was only 2 points in it, you see. And you managed to win overall the grand for day 6 so far.
Did I do best in the earlier games of this game? And now I'm not doing as well.
Yesterday,
one of the great days in
yesterday,
points of bad history.
I think you had the best day ever in points of bad. You only added 3 points with 4 games. You got 2 score-draw accurate predictions and you added 3 points in the other 2 games. It was a very impressive day.
Yeah.
Very impressive. Whereas John added 8, I added 11, Seb added 9. You really built up a bit of a lead there. But of course, John was leading up until today. So there you go. You can be glad to have taken over from him. It's all getting very tight. I forgot we were live then for a second.
Keep the headphones on so you remember that we're live.
Yeah, that's a good
idea.
There's
a lot of things.
All righty then. Seb Stafford-Bloor, thank you very much. We'll see you again tomorrow, I believe.
Yes, you will.
Yes, absolutely. JJ Bull, it's your day off tomorrow, but we'll be joined again by John McKenzie, won't we?
Yes, it's never a day off though, Joe. I watch all the games.
Yeah, except it literally is. Don, producer Don, and producer Jamie, thanks very much for your help today. Oh, they don't say, they don't talk. Forgot about that. And what was I going to say?
It's not a day off, though, is it?
Because there'll be days on for you coming up soon as well, because Seb's going to miss a couple of the round of 16 qualifying games. So it'll be a me, John, and JJ affair.
Wow.
And we'll get to have double board action. A bit like today, but different to today.
Rudy!
Okay, thank you very much for joining us, and we will see you again tomorrow night.